Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. And Jim, it was just on Friday where we were not very happy with President Obama, which I know is a very rare occurrence on this podcast. But in particular, on Friday, we were not very happy with his attitude towards the starting ground for Middle East peace talks. And that was Israel going back to its pre-1967 borders. And what was great on Friday, I thought, was just how Netanyahu very diplomatically but very clearly explained right in front of Obama, who clearly was stewing on the inside, how wrong he was and how Israel had no intention of making that the starting point or probably even the ending point of any Middle East peace negotiations. And it's been very interesting to watch Netanyahu during this visit. As we speak, he's addressing the U.S. Congress. We may have something to say about that tomorrow, depending upon the content of the speech. But here's what the prime minister had to say in his speech to AIPAC Monday night here in Washington.
Tomorrow in Congress, I'll describe what a peace between a Palestinian state and the Jewish state could look like. But I want to assure you of one thing. It must leave Israel with security. And therefore, Israel cannot return to the indefensible 1967 lines.
Two great things about this. Not only is Netanyahu standing up for what he obviously has to stand up for, the security of his own people, but I love the way he's doing this. And I think there's a lot of U.S. Republicans who could take a page out of his book.
Yeah, the tone is firm. It's not unnecessarily antagonistic, but it's very direct. It says things. There's no wiggle room. There's no what do you mean by that when it comes to Netanyahu speaking. I think one of the things that's kind of striking about this is you look at how, like, Obama knew he was giving this big address before Netanyahu came to town. And we know the relationship between Obama and Netanyahu has never been that strong. Clearly, it doesn't seem like, I don't know if you could say Obama was blindsided by it, but it's kind of intriguing that, you know, he either knew Netanyahu was going to react badly and went forward with it anyway, meaning he felt there was some sort of personal benefit to promoting an idea that had no chance of coming to fruition, or he didn't know. And it means that, you know, 2.5 years into his presidency, Barack Obama still doesn't understand what Netanyahu's position is, how he thinks, why he believes what he believes, et cetera, et cetera. I think when we know there's a lot of people who said that a lot of that big speech on the Middle East, particularly beyond the Israeli-Palestinian issue, was this. You look back to the Cairo speech and how much Obama cited his personal story and he cited his personal experience with the Muslim world and going to mosques in Indonesia, etc. And he really believed that he personally, by sheer magnetism of his personality, was going to get people to change their minds. And we're seeing this, you know, it's running into a brick wall in Netanyahu that Netanyahu doesn't care how charming Barack Obama is. He doesn't care how much, you know, he does these sorts of things. Now, I'm hearing a lot of Republicans say, aha, here it comes. Now, finally, the Jews are going to turn away from the Democrats. I would not encourage Republicans to get too excited about that for a lot of reasons. Among them, a couple intriguing polls in recent years that have indicated that despite kind of this popular conception, Israel is not really the big central issue for a lot of Jewish Americans. We can argue about whether it should be, but the bottom line is it is not something that's necessarily going to see this. You may see some change, you know, change in the behavior of certain traditionally, you know, high dollar donors to the Democratic Party, and certainly Republicans will be eager to welcome them with open arms to the Republican fold. It's possible Obama will do himself some damage with the Jewish community here, but I would not hold my breath waiting for a sea change in political perspectives in that demographic.
On to martini number two now, and the bad martini, and it comes from Massachusetts Republican Senator Scott Brown. In his latest opinion piece, he has basically pointed out that he will not be supporting the Ryan plan. He says it goes way too far. He also says that his approach to solving the Medicare insolvency issue is rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse, which means he doesn't really have an alternative to the Ryan plan. He just can't vote for it, thinking that that'll cost him a whole lot of support up in Massachusetts, and he probably will have to account for a position on this issue pretty soon, since Harry Reid is hoping to use this as a wedge issue against moderate Republicans in the Senate. This is the latest in a series of what I would call extremely disappointing decisions on the part of Scott Brown. We expected him to be pretty squishy on the social issues. He is from Massachusetts, after all, and he's never really been that great on those issues. So conservatives were saying, well, you know, he's probably going to be okay on the other two legs of the three-legged stool, foreign policy and the economy. Then he voted for the START treaty, which isn't necessarily a cardinal political sin, but it's not exactly something we were excited about. And everybody's like, well, he's good on the fiscal issues. That's what he ran on. He'll definitely come through there. And once again, he seems to have not come through. And I think a lot of conservatives agree with Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh, who had this to say to Fox News' Neil Cavuto.
Scott Brown ought to be ashamed of himself. This is the defining moment of this generation. We have got to be bold. We know these entitlements have to be reformed to be saved. He knows that. And any Republican that doesn't vote for this or doesn't support this is purely being guided by political reasons, and shame on them.
And Jim, obviously we've said before that Scott Brown is probably better than your typical Massachusetts liberal, but it's getting harder and harder to tell exactly why he would be better given his recent votes and certainly all the blood, sweat, and tears of Tea Party folks and everybody else about a year ago.
Yeah, and it's worth noting it wasn't just the vote or it wasn't just the stance, it was the tone. There was a lot of disappointment and anger expressed in the Morning Jolt this morning over this. If you're a Republican and you know that voting for the Ryan plan means the end of your career and you don't want to do that, okay. You know, particularly since you know that the Ryan plan is just going to get vetoed by Obama anyway. Then there are ways you can finesse this. And what you do is you go out there and you say you see the benefits of the Ryan plan. You realize that difficult choices must be made. But you've heard from your constituents. Your constituents are vehemently opposed. And you feel like you'd be doing a bad job of representing them if you ignored their objections. You know, and you kind of say, look, it's not me. It's my constituents. The next thing which you kind of observe is that if you have to vote no, you don't join in the Democratic rhetoric. You don't talk about this. And, you know, Scott Brown, particularly in the tone of his comments, really did. A lot of Republicans saw this as piling on and helping and, you know, helping add some Republican credibility to the charge that it's going to toss Granny out in the snow, et cetera. What's more is that if you're going to say no to the Ryan plan, all right. What's your alternative? And the only thing Brown had was some very predictable and very tired comments about eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse. All of us support eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, but if it was as easy as that, it would have been gone by now. That this is kind of a predictable way of punting on the issue, and it was, I think, you know, a lot of folks, including some folks who had been really, you know, vocal supporters of him back in 2009, really are disappointed by this and really are probably going to be, you know, never quite as enthusiastic about Scott Brown. As you said, we kind of knew, being from Massachusetts, he wasn't going to be with the party on everything. But this is the first one that really stings. And again, it's not just the vote. It's also the fact that he's sounding a little too much like a Democrat as he does this.
Yeah, he's clearly reading the political tea leaves as he thinks they currently exist. But he's got a lot of popularity up there. You could at least stick your neck out on a little bit of something.
Exactly. I mean, Greg, you and I have talked about the polling numbers for him are really surprisingly good. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee is kind of scratching their head of how a Republican can have numbers like this. So, I mean, what's the point of having that high approval rating if you won't, you know, use it? You know, use your stature to say to Massachusetts folks, look, here, you know, these are the parts of the plan you don't like, but here's why we think they're necessary. And at least make the argument. It's not going to vote on this tomorrow. So, you know, we'll see what happens. But again, I think a lot of Republicans aren't going to look at Scott Brown quite the same way after this.
Yeah, pretty disappointing. There's already reports that at least three Senate Republicans won't vote for the Ryan plan. I haven't seen the entire list, but I can pretty much guess what it looks like. It's not too hard. Let's move on to number three now. And this is just entertaining and bizarre on so many different levels. Let's goes back to the Bin Laden raid, and this is a story that we found from The Australian, and I'm just going to quote a couple paragraphs here. The three widows of Osama bin Laden are turning on each other in custody, Jim, with two older Saudi women blaming a much younger Yemeni wife for leading American intelligence to their hideout. It's vicious, said a Pakistani official briefed on the interrogations of the widows. The older wives think the younger one tipped off the Americans or was tracked when she came to join him. Although the compound where bin Laden hid for 5 years was large, the three wives were all cooped up in the same house. The older two lived on the second floor and the youngest one on the top. Their husband alternated between them. Pakistani officials who have been debriefing the women portray life in the compound as an Islamic version of Desperate Housewives. So, Jim, I guess regardless of your culture, some things never change.
Well, I was going to observe, did we learn nothing from Big Love about the difficulties of polygamy? You know, even the very best, well-meaning people, one husband, multiple wives, it really very rarely turns out well and often has a great deal of pain for everyone involved. As you were describing that, I was just envisioning some Saudi or Pakistani version of the First Wives Club, of them, you know, kind of just, oh, that bimbo he shacked up with. Ah, oh, where did he find her? You know, fascinating. Fascinating to watch. You know, it's, I guess you could say it's some sort of universal constant. There's something also, like, I obviously, if I'm a U.S. Intelligence agency, I'm doing everything I can to put this out as far and wide as possible. Because it's, you know, it's not deal. Look, he's the world's most wanted terrorist, but he's also a crappy husband. And, you know, that's, you know, this is one more thing to put on the list of Osama bin Laden's crimes, flaws, and sins. So, fascinating that. I wonder if he felt henpecked by all of that. You know, like, ugh, you know, I just killed thousands of Americans. Now I've got these guys, now these women, now they're griping and moaning and groaning. You know, the idea of him having to deal with all that in his last couple of years of his life, well, it gives me a little bit of comfort, you know.
Exactly.
There's never any domestic tranquility in the bin Laden house.
And I think later in the story, we found out a reason for some of the irritability. His first wife recounts how he refused to allow air conditioners or a refrigerator, even in the sweltering desert heat, because he was apparently a ginormous cheapskate in addition to all the other flaws that he had in his life. So it all adds up.
Oh, that
now.
Osama. What a cheapskate. You're a billionaire. You run a world terrorist organization. My father knew I should have married the. Told me I should have married the other guy.
Exactly right. Good to end on a laugh. And Jim, we'll talk tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.